happy to welcome you into the circle tonight. We are here to do one of our information sessions for One in the Spirit with Steve Moore, who is an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund out of Boulder, Colorado. And Steve was one of the people who was instrumental in being retained by the Native American Church on the recent case, Oregon versus Smith. Is that right? I should know, but I don't. I don't want to know either. But Steve will share with us a little bit of his perspective and maybe a little bit of what Native American Rights Fund is, what it does, and how Native American religious freedom is emerging. Is that okay? Great. Steve Moore.
I'm going to send these around in both directions. This is a small briefing sheet that I prepared to bring up here, dealing with the recent decision of the Supreme Court in Oregon versus Smith. What the decision will really mean to Native American church members who live out there in urban areas and on Indian reservations, because there may be significant differences between the two. I'd first like to start by saying for the video that I'm Steve Moore, and I'm an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund in Boulder, Colorado. And we're celebrating our 20th anniversary this year. And we're having a conference in Boulder the 31st of July and the 1st of August. If anyone wants more information about the conference, see me this weekend. And I'll give you our address so you can write and ask for a brochure. And the Native American Rights Fund has, we are a national nonprofit Indian law firm / Indian legal rights organization. Our central office is in Boulder, Colorado. We also have offices in Anchorage, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. We have 18 lawyers, 14 of whom are Native American. And we represent currently over 70 Indian tribes and individual Indians across the country in Alaska, continental United States, and in Hawaii. And we really do legal work, both law work, litigation, lawsuits, and legislative lobbying and advocacy in Washington on behalf of Native Americans. And our issue areas run the full spectrum of tribal sovereignty, the rights of tribal governments, the jurisdictional rights of those governments and their court systems, to protecting water rights, land rights. We get into the human rights area, the civil rights area, the rights of religious practitioners. I'm going to talk about that tonight specifically. We're currently involved in efforts to get Indian human remains repatriated out of museums around the country, the Smithsonian and other museums. That's an issue area of really active work for us right now in Washington, D.C. and various states around the country. And we really get involved in every conceivable aspect of Indian life, because the lives of Indian people in our country really are the most heavily regulated lives of any segment of our society. There are two thick volumes of the United States Code which pertain to nothing but Indian rights and the regulation of the lives of Indian people by the United States government. And then there's a whole separate code of federal regulations, all of the various agencies that influence the lives of Indian people. And so Indian people really know what it's like to be an oppressed, persecuted, and regulated segment of our society. Again, for the Indian people in the audience, I probably won't be saying anything new for you tonight. I may give you a different perspective as a lawyer and as a non-Indian, but you know the history of your relationship to this government and to the dominant society far better than I. It's really a pleasure for me to be here this weekend. And when Ramona invited me, it really came at a time in my life and in my professional work when I needed to get away. I needed a retreat of sorts to renew my strength and commitment to the work that I do. The Supreme Court decision came down, I think the 17th of April, about 10 days ago now. And in that case, and a case which came down 2 years ago involving the Go Road in Northern California, represented a major part of my work over the last 11 years since I've been out of law school. I first became involved in Indian issues when I was a new lawyer in Northern Idaho representing some Kootenai Indians from Idaho and Montana and British Columbia who were fighting to stop a dam and hydroelectric project on the Kootenai River. I was involved in that fight for 8 years, and we succeeded in defeating the license application to build that project and thus preserving a sacred waterfall to the Kootenai Indians. And much of that work hung on the lower court decision in the Go Road case, the district court decision out of the federal court in Northern California, and then the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Both courts upheld the rights of the Indian people to protect the high country from efforts by the Forest Service to develop a road and clear-cutting activities in that part of the forest. And the courts in that case were making new law, were really carving a new path for Native people, both under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, both of which I'll talk about tonight. But since that time, since about 1986, we've seen things change dramatically. And I think the lesson to be learned in the last 3 years or 4 years is that we live in very dangerous times for Native people, particularly in the area of religion and the preservation of your cultures. The courts, by and large, are of the frame of mind these days that they understand tribal governments, they understand the sovereign rights of tribes, and they understand the role and the place of tribal governments in our constitutional democracy. And so we see courts uphold the jurisdictional rights of tribes and the right to regulate the conduct of all people within the boundaries of Indian reservations, with some exceptions. But those rights are upheld by the courts in our country and recognized by Congress because the political institutions within tribal governments look a lot like the political institutions within the state and local governments in the dominant society. It's a familiar paradigm for the white dominant society's judicial system. And so it's taken a few years to establish those rights, but those rights, for the most part, are not eroding. The whole area of culture and religion for Indian people, though, is still under attack and siege by the dominant society. And in those areas, we don't see the court system understanding the issues that come before them and attempting to place those issues within a framework that is understandable to the court. And so we're seeing decisions from the courts that are really aberrations and, in my view, are sending Indian culture and religion back underground, or the decisions bring about the force that tends to push the religion and culture of Indian people, the religions and cultures of Indian people, back underground at a place where they had to go a century ago in order to survive. The Sun Dance was outlawed about 100 years ago, the Ghost Dance, Indian giveaways, the wearing of medicine bags and bundles, and the language. Children were tortured and beaten in boarding schools for speaking their native tongues, for attending religious ceremonies when they went home on the holidays and summer vacations. The religion was basically all but snuffed out by our government and by the churches, really working in complicity with the Indian agents that ran reservations. The religions were all but snuffed out. We saw, you know, the beginning seeds of resurgence in the mid-30s with the Indian Reorganization Act and the Indian New Deal era, which came about with the Roosevelt presidency. And it's taken a period of about 50 years, coinciding in the last couple of decades with some noteworthy events, you know, the Vietnam War era, the protests around the Vietnam War, the counterculture, the attempt at revolution within our society that kind of fractured everything loose. You know, Indians, in the civil rights movement, Indians were caught up and swept up and swept along in that movement to a point today where Indian culture and religion is really on the comeback. Now, that coincides with, again, this period of in our history when the courts are attempting, I think, to send us back into a more establishment mode and send the religion and culture of Indian people back underground. And so I think we live in very dangerous times for Indian people. It may be, in my view, nothing more than an effort by the establishment feeling very desperate about what's happening in our society to try and restore the status quo. I think, you know, the Earth Day movement, the green movement in America, what's going on in Eastern Europe, all of these different forces that are moving and shaking up the earth as we know it represent a great threat to the establishment. And decisions like the Peyote decision last week, in my view, represent a real crisis mentality on the part of the Supreme Court justices, trying to hold on, to clutch on to the establishment. Well, what that case represented to them, I think, the undercurrent of it was a real threat to the establishment, a real threat because religion was pitted against the will of majoritarian legislative power. And the court couldn't stomach the idea of a few Indians being able to dictate to the legislative establishment within our country, the real power base within our country, the way things were going to be. And throw in a little bit of hysteria around the drug crisis in America and the efforts of the Attorney General of the state of Oregon to pander to that hysteria around the use of peyote by Indians in religious ceremonies. And you really had a perfect case of conflict within the Supreme Court. And we thought that the results would be as they were. The Native American Church made a strong effort, coupled with the churches here in the Northwest, to persuade the Oregon Attorney General to settle that case out, to drop the case, to dismiss it, and pull it off the Supreme Court docket before it was argued, which he had the power to do. And we were unsuccessful in our efforts to do that, and we have the result that we've got today. The case involved a Klamath Indian, Al Smith, and a non-Indian, Galen Black, who were hired as drug counselors in Roseburg County, Oregon. They both admitted to using peyote as part of Native American church ceremonies and were dismissed from their jobs by the director of the program on the basis that they had signed a contract saying that they would remain drug-free during their tenure, their term of employment with the program. both of them felt that what they were doing, using peyote as part of a religious ceremony, the taking of a sacrament, was not the ingestion of drugs, and they didn't feel they were in violation of their contracts. But they were nonetheless dismissed and applied for unemployment compensation benefits to the state of Oregon. And were denied benefits, appealed the denial all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court, where they won. And the court held that their right to take peyote was protected under the First Amendment, that it was not job-related misconduct, and because it was not job-related misconduct, under the unemployment compensation statutes, they were ordered, the Oregon Supreme Court ordered the Employment Compensation Division to award them benefits. The case was then appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1986, the Supreme Court sent it back down on a technicality of state law. The court wanted to know if they had violated the criminal laws of the state of Oregon, and whether the Oregon Constitution would have nonetheless upheld their right to take peyote. The Oregon Supreme Court, and the decision that time was a 5-3 vote of the court. Justice Powell was not on the court, so there were only 8 members of the court at that time. The vote was 5-3 at that time, which we saw as a very dangerous signal. You know, we thought if this case does go back up a second time, we're likely to get a 5-3 or 6-3 vote, and the second time it was a 6-3 vote against the religion. So this, when the case went back down to the Oregon Supreme Court, they decided the question that the Supreme Court wanted them to decide, and the case then, Attorney General Frohnmayer from Oregon sent the case back or asked the Supreme Court to review the case a second time, and they agreed to do so. At this time, the question before the court was the federal constitutional question: is the right to possess and use peyote by members of the Native American Church a right protected under the U.S. Constitution? Now, in kind of a strange twist of fate, the criminality of that conduct got kind of caught up in the case. These guys were never prosecuted under the state criminal laws for their use of peyote, which would have been a more, I think, genuine or honest way, a forthright way of the Attorney General bringing the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, is to bring a prosecution of church members for their use of peyote. They try to sneak the state criminal interest in the back door by arguing that the state had an interest in preventing this kind of drug abuse, and that outweighed the rights of the individuals to use peyote under the First Amendment. So this case ended up reading almost as if it was a case involving the criminal prosecution of these two men, but in fact they never were prosecuted under the state's criminal laws. And that's an important element of this whole case for legal reasons, and I'll try and touch on that without driving the non-lawyers in the place crazy, which is, involves everyone in this room but me. And I sometimes wonder why I got into the practice of law and how I slipped into it and how I realized I talk like a lawyer and no one understands what I'm saying. I can't understand why you don't understand what I'm saying. But what we've got left with now is a decision, and this is really a decision. It was written so broadly that it's a concern to all people who take religion in their lives seriously. The Supreme Court held, first of all, that the right to possess and use peyote by members of the Native American Church is not a right protected under the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. The Constitution says Congress shall pass no laws respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And this case was a case involving the free exercise of religion. And the First Amendment applies to states through the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Now, the court created kind of a constitutional limbo land, I call it, because while it said this religion is not protected under the free exercise clause, it's not prohibited, it's not outlawed under the establishment clause of the First Amendment. I'm getting into another area that drives non-lawyers crazy. What does he mean by that? Well, huh? Are you asleep, Ted?
I didn't mean to say that.
You fall asleep when you talk to your lawyer. Ramona, do you have a lawyer's joke here?
I'm listening intently.
What I mean by the Establishment Clause is that under the Establishment Clause, government is not supposed to establish religion in our country. There's supposed to be a wall of separation between church and state. And that's a wall that is not meant to be crossed over by governments. Now, it happens all the time. That wall is pretty illusory. There are federal subsidies to parochial schools, for example. What the Establishment Clause today means is that all religions should be treated equally, and there's an attempt at neutrality by the courts in terms of the government treatment with religion, dealing with religion. And this court said that this religion and the protection of this religion does not violate, by government, does not violate the Establishment Clause, meaning there's no special protection for the Native American Church. It's, the court's not singling out the Native American Church for special protection under the Constitution. And so what the court said in bottom terms was that while legislatures are not required to, state legislatures or the Congress is not required to pass laws exempting the religious use of peyote. Again, peyote is a Schedule I controlled substance in this country under federal and state drug laws. It's a hazardous drug. It's a hallucinogenic drug. It presents a serious threat to the safety and health and welfare of citizens of the United States. But a number of states have exemptions for the religious use of peyote. Federal Drug Enforcement Administration has an exemption for the religious use of peyote. Congress hasn't spoken on the issue directly. And so the court said that legislatures of the various states and Congress are not required to pass exemptions under the First Amendment, meaning there's no free exercise protection for this religion. But they are permitted to do so, meaning there's no Establishment Clause violation if a legislature does that. And that's, if there's any redeeming value in it, in this decision, it's that last part of that statement. Legislatures are permitted to pass exemptions. Now, the devastating impact of that is that, and let me say first that there are 11 states that have exemptions for the religious use of peyote from state drug laws. And there are another 12 that tie their exemption to the federal scheme, which can be said to exempt the religious use of peyote. So about half the states have protections in place for the Native American Church. But there are a couple important states that do not right now. Some states had protection for the church under court decisions, like the Smith case in Oregon, People Against Woody in California, case Whitehorn in the state of Oklahoma. Now, California and Oklahoma are two big Native American church states. State of Nebraska also does not have a statutory exemption. Idaho does not have a statutory exemption. In all of these states today, in fact, tomorrow night, if there are Native American church ceremonies in those states, those Indians conducting those ceremonies are criminals in the eyes of the laws of those states and could be prosecuted for commission of state felonies and could be sent to prison in those states for the practice of their religion. This is a religion that's 10,000 years old. It's one of the oldest continuously practiced religions in North America. And these people are criminals tonight. That's one of the most devastating aspects of this case. The other devastating aspect of it is that it again subjects Indian people to the will and the whim of non-Indian legislatures, dominant society majoritarian legislatures, some of which have acted sympathetically to the Native American Church and have adopted these statutory exemptions, but some of which have not. I mean, the state of Idaho, for example, just this last legislative session voted against. In fact, an exemption for the Native American Church didn't even make it out of committee in the Idaho legislature. It was voted down in committee. So there are a lot of states around the country that have no sympathy and no tolerance for this religion. We're living in times, again, of drug hysteria and the war on drugs, and a lot of that is, most of that I agree with, but this church should not get caught up in that hysteria and irrationality around drug abuse in our society. But it's probably the worst of all possible times for the Native American Church to be shoved back into the state legislative arena to have to fight for free exercise protection. It returns us again to an era around the turn of the century, the latter part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century, when there was a concerted effort to drive the Peyote religion out of existence. The Peyote religion has a really interesting history of persecution going back to the 17th century when there were papal edicts issued by the Pope in Rome that people practicing the Peyote religion be imprisoned, and a lot of Peyotes in Mexico were sent to jail for their entire lives, 300 years ago, for the practice of their religion. The Spanish missionaries had a lot of fervor and were fervent in terms of driving this religion, stamping it out of existence. And so the church is probably one of the most persecuted churches in the world, in addition to being one of the oldest. There will be problems as the fact sheet indicates, even in states where there are Indian reservations and the Indian reservations are protected from the reach of state criminal laws, there are going to be problems of transporting peyote across the highways of that state. Peyote has only grown in the only place in the world is the Rio Grande River Valley in Texas and Mexico. The Native American Church down on the Navajo Reservation is thinking about setting up a greenhouse and growing it on the reservation as a response to the court's decision last week. But there's a complex distribution scheme to get peyote around to the various parts of the country, the Dakotas and up here in the Northwest, Yakima, Colville, so that ceremonies can be conducted. And it's conceivable that very serious problems could arise in terms of trying to get the peyote up to the various places where the church chapters exist. And so while the future is really unknown, states could do almost anything at this point, there is this grave threat. There is an invitation now from the Supreme Court that it's open season again on Indian religion, Indian peyote religion, and that it's okay to repeal the exemptions that legislatures have adopted. In fact, the Attorney General in Arizona made a statement to the press last week that sounded to me like an invitation to the conservative elements in the legislature in Arizona to repeal their exemption. And it's just the wrong time to be introducing this kind of element back into to Indian culture and Indian society, and again, as I pointed out earlier, in a period of resurgence and revitalization of religion and culture to Indian people, to now be told that your religion is one of the only religions in the country that's not protected at all by the First Amendment. Now, the way I said that the decision was written broadly, it was written so broadly as to say that any time a legislature passes, and this is why even the non-Indian people in the room should take note, any time a legislature or the Congress passes a law of general applicability to all citizens, if that law happens to incidentally infringe upon practice of some religious ritual or conduct, the members of that religious community have no standing or no cause of action, no basis under the First Amendment to challenge that legislative enactment. You don't even have the right to go into court under the Free Exercise Clause as a matter of free exercise of religion and challenge what that legislature has done. And there's a real live example of that today, a really interesting case about 6 weeks before the Smith case was argued in the U.S. Supreme Court last November. The Minnesota Supreme Court came down with a decision involving the Amish, a case involving the prosecution of several Amish community members for refusing to put fluorescent orange triangles on the back of their buggies. There's a law in Minnesota that requires all slow-moving vehicles to have, this is a criminal law, all slow-moving vehicles shall have large fluorescent orange triangles on the back, like tractors that we see driving down the side of county roads. And the Amish refused to do so, because that was, in their terms, in their worldview, their cosmology would infringe upon their religion and their way of life. And the U.S. Supreme Court, before in dealing with Amish cases, has said that the Amish way of life is based in religion. And that those principles have never been accepted by the court when taking up Indian cases, which is interesting. But these Amish people were prosecuted and had to pay a $25 fine and appealed those prosecutions through the courts up to the Minnesota Supreme Court. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said that their right to refuse to put the triangle on their buggies was protected religious conduct, protected under the Free Exercise Clause, and that as applied to them, that law was unconstitutional, creating an exemption for the Amish. And that's the usual way that courts have applied the First Amendment in these kinds of cases. In light of the Smith decision, the Oregon and the Minnesota, the state of Minnesota had appealed that decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they granted review. And last week, based on the Smith decision, they sent the Durenberger case back to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and the instructions are pretty clear. Your decision now is contrary to our decision in Smith. Our word is the supreme law of the land. We are the Supreme Court, so change your ruling. So now, in light of the Smith decision, unless the Minnesota Supreme Court can find a very creative way of trying to distinguish Smith, the Minnesota Supreme Court will be left with the choice to uphold the convictions and rule that that religious conduct is not protected under the First Amendment, and that you don't even have a basis to go into court under the Constitution and challenge it. Another case example that comes to my mind is circumcision. And there's some movement against circumcision in the United States these days. In some communities, it's fallen out of vogue. It's not inconceivable that a state legislature could pass a law outlawing the practice of circumcision. If a legislature did that, the Orthodox Jewish community would have no basis to complain under the Constitution that that law, as applied to their community, violated their beliefs and conduct, which is rooted in religion. And so what this does is that it elevates the legislative branch over religious belief and practice in our society. It now puts legislatures in a position where they can dictate what kinds of religious conduct and rituals are considered legal and what kinds of religious conduct is maybe considered illegal and outlawed. And that's a dangerous precedent. The court in Smith reached back to 1879 to a case, the Reynolds case, involving the practice of polygamy among Mormons in Utah. And there was not a case that they could rely on between 1879 and 1990, 111 years, to support their decision in Smith. And they had to distinguish away a whole line of cases over the last 30 years that upheld this practice of balancing the interests of the state versus the interests of a religious community and the possibility of creating an exception for certain religious practices, exceptions from the application of that law. It's really fascinating to me in light of the events in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, especially the Soviet Union, where we're seeing today, you know, the resurgence of the Christian movement. And churches are coming out of the cellar. They're coming up from the underground in the Soviet Union in what we have always considered to be totalitarian states, where the will of the central state dictated the kinds of conduct that the individuals in that society could be engaged in. And that's exactly what's happening in our society. It's turned around 180 degrees here. Legislatures are now being told by Congress that they can dictate what activity and what forms of conduct that we as individuals in the society can engage in. And that if the incidental effect happens to destroy religions, so be it. The Native American church cannot be practiced. The church, the religion, cannot be practiced without the sacrament, without peyote. And yet this court seems to say that a legislature can take that sacrament away from the practitioners of that religion. And that even if you destroy the religion, it doesn't matter. You don't have any way of challenging the decision of that legislature, the enactment by that legislature. And we, in my view, have taken the first step toward totalitarianism by doing so. Now, I don't know if the threat is as real as it was in the Soviet Union. Certainly not, going back to 1916 and the Russian Revolution and the beginnings of totalitarianism in the Soviet Union. But if you are a member of a religious minority, like a practitioner of the peyote religion, this decision can only feel like the decision of a totalitarian nation, dictating what conduct you can and cannot engage in. And in my view, the decision last week was and represents a devastating blow to our democratic faith and our constitutional democracy here in the United States. The very principles of religious freedom upon which this country was supposedly founded have been turned on their head and turned inside out and rendered meaningless by and large. Now, this, I don't know how I'm doing for time. This decision follows almost 2 years to the day a decision by the Supreme Court in another case that a lot of Indian people here are familiar with, the Goh Road case out of Northern California. There, the Supreme Court was again faced with a religious free exercise challenge by American Indians, by members of Northern California tribes, to a decision of the U.S. Forest Service to build a road through what's called the High Country. there are a number of religious shrines in the high country, and pilgrimages are made by individuals from those tribes to the high country for vision questing, for the receipt of medicine, power, healing ceremonies. And the power is invested then in those people to become medicine people, to take that power back to their communities and take up the role of a medicine person within their society. The high country was an essential part, of the religion of the Northern California Indians. In that case, again, the Supreme Court held that there was no cause of action, there was no right under the First Amendment to challenge a government agency decision about what it would do with its own land. Again, the cruel irony there is that the Northern California Indians, this was within their aboriginal territory. It had been established, as a matter of fact, at trial. We were here first. This is our land. This is our, you know, the center of our religious and spiritual world. But it's also Forest Service land. And the court there said, because the federal government owns this land, you can't challenge what the government decides to do with its land on the basis of the First Amendment. And anything that the government does with that land, even to the point of destroying the religion, which the experts in that case, even the Forest Service experts at trial, admitted that the religion would be destroyed, that it would break down, that this whole process of the development of medicine people and the transmission of spiritual knowledge and power from the spirits to the people would be cut off, would be severed. The religion would be destroyed. Even under those circumstances, they had no basis under the First Amendment to challenge what the government did. Again, the will of the majoritarian government against the will of the people. Who wins? The government won.
Is that a 6-3 vote also?
6-3.
Oh, it's 5-3.
Sorry, 5-3.
Kennedy wasn't on
the court. Yeah, Kennedy was not on the court yet when the cert was granted. Seems to be a clear case of discrimination to me. The case that the court relied on in Ling, in the Go-Road case, was a case that had come down 2 years prior to that involving the assignment of a Social Security number to an Abenaki Indian. Another Indian case. Three Indian cases to the Supreme Court on Indian religious issues in 6 years. Three losses. All of the cases won below. Okay. So a lot of people can say, well, why are you even taking these cases to the courts? Well, there are cases where either you go into the courts or you let them build the road. You know, you let them violate your religion. Cases where the Indians had won all the way up and then were severed, were shut down at the Supreme Court level. In that case, the Abenaki Indian case, the Indian objected to the Social Security Administration assigning him and his daughter Social Security numbers. The court there said that the government can't force them to use the Social Security number, but the government can assign them a number and use that number internally within the government to track the receipt of Social Security benefits or whatever. It was an internal operation of the government. They used that principle in the Ling case, in the Go-Road case, and said what the government's doing with its own land is purely internal government decision-making. Okay? And based on that, there's no challenge under the First Amendment. Even if there's some incidental effect on, again, this notion of incidental effect, if some religion, if Indian religion just gets caught up in the machinery of the dominant society and decisions that machinery makes about what's good for the society, there's no way of challenging it under the First Amendment. Indians don't have rights under the First Amendment. There's no religious freedom for Indian people in American society today. It's the only conclusion you can reach. There's no way of rationalizing or explaining any other result. I've tried. But I come back to one point, one principle. Native American people don't have the right to practice their religion, their traditional religions in our society. It's not protected conduct. It's subject to the will of the legislative branch and the will of the majoritarian dominant society. And that can shift and twist and turn like the changing directions of the wind. And as Indian people know, I mean, the impact of the Smith decision this week is not profound. Probably nothing has changed in the last 10 days since that case came down. But that decision will be on the books for the next 150, 200, 300, 400, 500 years. Okay? Decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court are almost never overturned. And so Indian people have to live under the threat of their religious freedom. Your religious freedom exists at the sufferance of a branch of government in our society over which you have almost no control or influence. Any Indians in this room that have been involved in the legislative process know how difficult it is to go to Congress to protect or enforce or uphold, to have your rights recognized. It's a very difficult, time-consuming process. We're now looking at, in the Smith case, we're looking at a very long struggle to get Congress to recognize the religious use of peyote. There could be outbreaks of and reactions to the peyote religion in Arizona and other states. That will have to be fought in that legislature. And that's going to take money, it's going to take time, it's going to take a lot of special interest groups lining up with Indian people. And that's in part what brought me to meet some wonderful people in this room like John, Ron Adams, who's asleep somewhere. Where are you, Ron? He's not even here.
I am listening.
You're asleep with Ted down here. When I came up here last August and started nosing around, one idea that I had in mind was the churches in the Northwest, the apology that John's going to talk about in a minute. When this apology was issued, the Church Council also made a contribution to the Native American Rights Fund in our work for Indian religious freedom. And I pulled that out and I thought, as it means, these people are willing to act on these words. They've made a commitment and they put it on paper to go into action on behalf of Indian people. And so I called, I don't know who I called first, I started calling, who are these people? I started calling Seattle, and I got John's name. And I don't know if you remember that first time I called, but I said, you know, I'm representing the Native American Church, and we've got to put a stop to this peyote case. And John said, I hear you, I know what you're saying, I know what you need. And we mobilized in the period of 6 weeks or something like that. We mobilized the bishops, we mobilized church leaders, we mobilized the press, and Ramona, and everyone, just, you know, you knew. It took one phone call, and within a minute and a half, the people knew what we wanted, and they knew what they had to do. And we mobilized such an assault on Dave Frommeyer, the Attorney General. We hit Salem for a whole week, and we had 16-hour meetings with him, and we brought in his best friends in the state, people who had supported him politically for years, and he's a rising star in Oregon, and he's going to be governor, and he's going to be congressman or senator, and he wants to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. And we hit him so hard that week, I thought there was no way that he couldn't buckle under. But he didn't. He didn't buckle under. He knew, and if you read his briefs, he knew what the Supreme Court would do. Because he's a member of the establishment, and he knew they would deliver for him. All he had to do was give them the right words. All he had to do was just use the vocabulary of the oppressor, and he could bring it home. And he knew he was not going to buckle under, because he was going to win this case. He's won 5 out of the 6 cases he's argued in the U.S. Supreme Court, and he knows how to handle them. They're like putty in his hands. And we hit him so hard, and the press hit him hard, and I thought he was going to buckle under, but he didn't. And I don't know, I'm back now because we've got to go to Congress. You know, we've got to worry about the various states and what might break out for the peyote religion. And I've just known for a long time that the churches here and the network that the churches have created from the Northwest and all over this country is really strong. And when called upon, they'll do the right thing. The people who are active in churches know, they have a strong sense. You have a strong sense of morality and justice. You're not caught up in the kind of ego power games that Dave Frohnmayer is dominated by, that dominate his life. And it really is ego and power against morality and justice. And I think that this is a beautiful alliance between Indian people and the Lutheran community and other churches in the Northwest. It doesn't exist with this kind of intensity anywhere else in the country, but it's something that should be capitalized upon and should spread like wildfire. I think we're coming to a point in our world that we realize that we are one in the spirit, that what we call the Great Spirit, Wankantanka, Nupika, whatever it is to different Indian communities, you know, we all pray to that same spirit. And it is that spirit within us that can deliver us to freedom. And I think that we're at a period, I strongly feel that we're at a period in our society and in the history of the world where we all must come together. The Supreme Court, if anything, has even brought us one step closer to this kind of crisis mentality, the kind of crisis and conflict within our society that can fracture the establishment and can allow new thoughts and ideas and feelings emerge. A new age can emerge for all of us. And I think we have to suffer the pain and injustice of the court in our lives and in the lives of our children, but it will bring about something new for all of us down the road, a time when people like Dave Frohnmayer and Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court, those kinds of ego-driven individuals will not dominate our world. The world will be dominated by love and joy and spirit. So I'm beginning to spin myself way out into the cosmos now, and I'm going to stop, and I'd be happy to take any questions or answer anything you might want to raise.
Can you touch on Sandra Day's, she was one of the 6, of course, but she also had said that they had gone way too far. Can you elaborate a little on that, or get any of that?
Yeah, in the Smith case, I touched on that briefly when I said that the court didn't use the kind of balancing test. The court threw out the balancing test in the peyote case. The test that says, okay, a legislature has passed a law as applied, that law infringes on religion. It is religious conduct. It's the people are sincere, and so there's a balancing of the interests of the state and the interests of the individual, the religious practitioner. And is there some way of creating an exception to that law for those people that doesn't harm society's needs? And kinds of cases were a case involving the Amish, again, out of Wisconsin this time. It was the Yoder case, a public school law, a law of the state of Wisconsin that required children to attend public school through the 12th grade. The Amish pulled their kids out of public schools after the 10th grade and sent them through vocational training in their own communities to become farmers, blacksmith, whatever. And that case went to the U.S. Supreme Court about 20 years ago. And the Supreme Court that time upheld the right of the religious community. Again, this decision to pull the kids out of public schools was based in religion, the religious communal sense of the Amish people. And the court said that, as applied, Wisconsin law did violate their religion. And there was a way of creating an exception for the Amish that would still meet the needs of a larger society. That kind of balancing and the kind of give and take, if you will, that allowed the free exercise of religion by all religions. We're not a country of just a handful of religions. There are literally hundreds of religions out there dotting the landscape. And any time, Scalia said in Smith that if we were to rule any other way, every individual would be a law unto himself, a conscience unto himself, and that individual conscience could dictate in our society. He called it anarchy. It threatened, in Scalia's mind, it threatened anarchy in American society if individuals, based on religion, could dictate to legislatures. Well, individuals or religious minorities don't. They're not trying to change the way all of society acts. They just want some space for their own particular religious conduct, religious practices. So this idea of anarchy is just tripe in my mind. Scalia he's just spinning out there in his own intellectual mind games. And that's what O'Connor was criticizing. She said you didn't have to go that far to create this new test, or to, in fact, take away the First Amendment rights of all people to challenge the laws of the legislature.
I think a lot of us could probably speak to the two-sided system of justice we have in the United States for Indians and white people, but I'm wondering, just hearing some of the things you've been saying about this new decision, if it will affect a lot of issues that are very important to the white majority church, for instance, tax-exempt status of churches, that churches do not have to license their daycares, the whole issue of conscientious objection to serving in the military. Is that going to affect that?
It will, unless the legislatures have exemptions for those kinds of practices. In fact, in states that don't have a specific exemption for the serving of communion to minors, and I think a lot of states do, but if there's a state out there that right now does not, in express terms in its laws, exempt that from the state criminal laws for giving alcoholic substances or beverages to minors, those priests could be prosecuted. And we're looking for a state right now. We're going to find a state that doesn't have that law. We're going to find a priest that would cooperate with us, a local police department that would cooperate with us, and we're going to set up a test case and send it right back to the Supreme Court. We'll get a Catholic priest out there, okay, to serve wine to a minor and have him busted and thrown in jail. That's the kind of assault on the Supreme Court that has got to be undertaken.
Is that the only way to challenge this?
Well, there are...
I mean, I think it's a good way to challenge it.
Yeah. Well, you know, John and I had talked about an idea of maybe a national day of mourning for the Native American church, where perhaps churches around the country would cooperate and would not serve the sacrament on a Sunday. You know, the blood of Christ would be held back that day in a symbolic protest what is happening to the Native American church. There are those forms of protest that could be made. But, you know, this decision's on the books now, and it's on the books forever.
Steve, I was wondering then, but, you know, I can understand their position in that, but yet how would you suggest, I mean, it seems like there needs to be some sort of guidelines, and are you guys drawing up some plans to help, also in a positive sense, to say, yeah, we understand there needs to be some guidelines to religions. I mean, you know, you can't go out and do, say, what Charles Manson did in the name of what he believed was right for his religious beliefs.
Or religions that dismember fingers or... Yeah.
Are you helping the Supreme Court to think...
Well, those religions are taken care of. That kind of dangerous religious conduct is taken care of under the balancing test that was swept away in this decision. Mm-hmm. That O'Connor criticized. I don't have a lot of faith in O'Connor. She wrote the decision in the Goroad case, so I'm not real crazy about her. But she was of the mind that the way this balancing test was set up would take care of those cases. If you've got a religion out there that really does threaten the lives of people, and cases that have come before the court involve snake handling. Although there are some Indian, some Pueblo societies in New Mexico, I think, that still have snake dances and still use snakes in religious ceremonies. But there have been cases involving snake handling, dismemberment, where fingers and you know, limbs were cut off as part of religious ceremonies. Human sacrifice would not be allowed in our society. That would be taken care of under this balancing test. And that's the way to take care of those religions. Get into some difficult issues with Christian Scientists and children. There was a case involving Christian Science, you know, in the courts recently, and parents had a child with kidney failure, should have been on dialysis, and they thought that prayer was the answer, and they refused to put their kid on a dialysis machine. Child died. Now being prosecuted for negligent homicide or something. So those are taken care of. You know, courts get in and they look at the religious practice and they judge the interests of society and they make those kind of decisions. And that's what we ask, that's the authority that we give to judges and courts in our society, to make those hard calls. And Scalia and the Supreme Court in this Peyote case seem to be saying, hey, we don't want to assume that role. We're going to leave it to the legislatures to take care of those questions. O'Connor and the three members, O'Connor agreed with the result in the Smith case of putting the religious practice out of business, so to speak. She felt that the use of peyote was dangerous and would have ruled in favor of the state in the balancing test. Three members of the court would have applied the balancing test and would have ruled in favor of the peyote religion. And then there were these five other guys that, five white males that swept away the balancing test and said, you don't even challenge the actions of legislatures when they pass these general laws. So that's the way to take care of religious practice, conduct rooted in religion that is really dangerous. And you look hard at if the conduct really is dangerous, like in the case of peyote. It's proven clinically and genetically to not be addictive and to not be destructive genetically. And there's no street use of peyote. It's not a drug that's sold on the streets. There's not an active illegal trade and trafficking in peyote. Peyote was put on the controlled substance list in the 60s because its synthetic derivative, mescaline, was a real popular hallucinogenic drug and may still be. But peyote itself is, I don't know if there are any people in the room who've taken peyote. It's really tough to handle. You know, it usually induces vomiting. It's not a pleasant drug to use. And Native American church members don't use it outside of a religious ceremonial setting. So the court could have looked at this case and searchingly examined the interests of the religion and the interests of the state. Oregon argued that there's, you know, drugs are out of control in Oregon, and that this was part of fighting the war on drugs in the state of Oregon to put this religion out of business. Frommeyer said before the Supreme Court, We, the elected leaders of the state of Oregon, have a responsibility to protect the members of the Native American Church from themselves. Those are his words. They don't know what they're doing to their bodies. We have an obligation to protect them from themselves, which is just bunk. I know doctors and lawyers, Indian doctors and lawyers, who are members of the church. They're not whacked out druggies, and that's the image that these white judges on the Supreme Court had in their minds. They saw peyote religious practitioners. They couldn't distinguish them from the drug dealer or the junkie in the alleys in Washington, D.C., or the people that run the crack houses in Washington. That's what they saw when they saw the peyote religion. And it's not written in the literal language of the decision, but you know it's there. They said, we got to stamp this religion out. It's dangerous.
The Attorney General painted that picture.
In his briefs and in his oral argument. And he told us, you know, during the week we were negotiating with him, I have nothing wrong with this religion, you know. I'm just doing my job. I'm upholding the laws of the state of Oregon. The legislature said this is criminal conduct, when in fact all the legislature in Oregon had done was adopt the federal drug laws. They had never been asked to consider an exemption for the religious use of peyote. They were silent and neutral on the subject. And he read so much more into the enactment of the drug laws by the legislature.
Yeah. In view of the fact that it's called the law of the land now, what do you see on behalf of those who disagree with that decision? What can be done? What would be the steps that would change
that? Yeah, the only route is legislative at this point, but...
At the congressional level?
Yeah. Native American Church needs a law passed by Congress which protects their ceremonial use of peyote. Right now, the federal drug laws do not have such an exemption. The DEA has a regulation on the books. It's been on the books for 20 plus years. The DEA works with the Native American Church, and there's a registration system for members of the church who distribute peyote from Texas throughout the U.S. But the DEA right now is operating without any statutory authority, which is really dangerous because if they got sued for some reason, they're acting, you know, beyond the scope of their official authority, which Congress gives them. And there could be government liability. It's hard to imagine the situation, but they're operating without any direction from Congress. And they could say, you know, wait, and call in all the registration cards, say that's it until we hear from Congress. That's a reality right now. They could say that. They haven't done it. One thing that needs to be done, the church leaders right now are meeting various parts of the country, forming a delegation of leaders to go to Washington to meet with the Justice Department, the Attorney General, Thornburg, the heads of the DEA, to try and shore all this up and say, all right, now what's going to happen? What are you guys going to do? Are you going to stand tight? Are you going to hold firm until Congress acts? One scenario is they could just pull out and say, no. And could be forced, I mean, if the Attorney General said, no, all bets are off, we will start active prosecutions of the church. They are authorized to do so currently under federal law. U.S. attorneys could be ordered to start shutting down peyote ceremonies right now. And that's really in any state, and that's on any Indian reservation. Because federal law applies. Federal criminal laws apply in Indian country. So the most pressing and immediate threat is on the federal level.
I don't understand specifically what Congress can do to, would they be taking it out of the hands of the state level then? I don't understand.
Well, there's, I guess, two answers to that. There's federal drug laws and then there's state drug laws. And Congress just passes laws or creates exemptions to those laws on a federal level. Mm-hmm. And that then tells U.S. attorneys whether to prosecute cases in federal court. And then there's a whole second tier of state laws and local district attorneys that prosecute those laws. There is a possibility that Congress could pass a law that said, as a matter of federal preemption under the Commerce Clause, that includes Indian tribes, that as a matter of federal interstate commerce, this exemption for the peyote religion will be the law of the land. And federal laws in those situations can be the law of the land. So one thing that we're playing around with right now would be a federal law that would make the religious use of peyote the law of the land in all the states. And states then could not pass laws saying, no, it's not protected conduct. That would be extraordinarily difficult to pull off, because all of the 50 states would scream. There's a, you know, in our system of federalism, there's a tension between state and federal power. States are very jealous about the power that Congress usurps. And that raises a whole different set of constitutional issues. So we're just kind of sorting things out right now and working with the leadership of the Native American Church.
It seems to me that we've got to parlay some of the compelling things that catch the emotions, like the 18,000 remains in Smithsonian and the desecrations. And it seems that using those kinds of the drama and the horror of those kinds of things, I think that we've got to try and lever those other kind of excessive kinds of things that, such as this, you know, in retrospect, I think there's another question that I am troubled by as a tribal leader, and that has to do with the ability of Indian leadership and their legal representation to be selective in the precedent setters. And we too have Indian egos and Indian whatever out there that often doesn't allow the best case to be tested. And I know that we've made some attempts. Is there any dialogue that occurs so that whatever is going to be setting the precedent, it would seem logical that, you know, like I know in the case of Puyallup fishery, they had a piddling little amount of money. Yeah. And logically, the state's going to pick the smallest and weakest and look for the things that are, you know, where they're probably likely to prevail. And I get troubled, and I want to know, and I'd like a little bit of a response from you on that one. And also, then I know that the Western Attorney Generals are organized, and Frohmeyer and Eikenberry, you know, a bunch of those. And comment a little bit on that too, would you please?
Okay. Yeah, I'll do the second one first, because it's easier to answer. Yeah, the Western Attorneys General, the top lawyer in each state in the Western United States, has an organization, and they're very active against Indian rights in most instances. In the case of the amendments to the American Indian Religious Freedom Act that are presently in Congress, the one man who represented the American Mining Congress and the Timber Producers Association and all of the interest groups in the forests who would not like to see Indians have more power over what occurs on public lands was Scott Matheson, the former governor of the state of Utah. And he's testified in the two hearings before Congress on amendments to the Indian Religious Freedom Act. He tried to get the Western Governors Association to back him to adopt a resolution opposing any changes to the Indian Religious Freedom Act. And their staff person called us and said, and tipped us off that Matheson was doing this. And we got to the Attorney General from North Dakota, who's chairman of that association, that group right now, and briefed him and his staff people, and they were able to kill Matheson's resolution. But they're very powerful, and they're very active. They write a lot of amicus briefs in the Supreme Court and Indian cases. They're routinely up there pressing the state side of the tension between tribal governments and state governments.
No, I think one of the things that we need to know is precisely who are they? So that, you know, sometimes we're going to encounter some where we may not need to invest energy.
Well, and that ties into the first part of your question about how you select cases. Yeah. Sure, this is not a business of just lawyers running wild out there bringing any case that we can get our hands on. I know Ramona thinks so. I heard that laugh.
But we have had some bad ones.
We've had, you know, and after the Oliphant decision,
a
case involving the right of tribes to prosecute non-Indians on Indian reservations when a misdemeanor law of the tribe is violated. That case went to the Supreme Court, you know, 17 years ago, or something like that, 15 years ago now, and tribes lost the right to arrest non-Indians and haul them into tribal court and throw them in tribal jail if they were, you know, breaking the criminal laws of the tribe. That case involved Oliphant was which tribe?
Suquamish.
You know, a small reservation in an urban area, and the facts were not good for that case. And you're right. I mean, I think we try and pick good cases. Now the Smith case. You know, my clients, the Native American Church, said we would have never jeopardized our rights. You know, we would, if Al Smith had come to the leadership of the church, we would have counseled him to not apply for unemployment benefits. He went to a lawyer in Roseburg, Oregon, that no one knows. He's not within the community of Indian law lawyers. And the guy said, "You got rights. Go for the unemployment benefits." And so both Al Smith and the white guy applied, and the case was off and running. You know, we first heard about it when it was in the Oregon Court of Appeals. So some of these cases just, you know, come out of nowhere. And you're right, there should be more control, because the risks in the court system are too great.
Steve.
Go Road is a case where they had no choice. That road was going through unless they fought. Yeah.
I hate to
cut me off. Yeah,
I hate to break in, but I know that people are tired and, you know, they've had a long day, and you will be present with us this weekend.
Right.
And please feel free to come and engage Steve in conversation. And Ted, some of the questions you've raised are some of the key issues that we really have to address and lift up out of this conference this weekend. So we're going to excuse you. We're not going to make you stay here and listen to John Magnuson talk about the apology. That will be tomorrow, John, if that's okay.
I'm going to have some ice cream.
Good. We can relax. Let's just relax and do whatever we need to do. And breakfast is at 8 tomorrow, from 8 to 8:30. So you're dismissed.
Yeah.
I'm not a student for
the
doing.
The snack bar is up in the hotel, and the sauna is, we have two saunas, but it'll be the inner city sauna that'll be lit, which is right behind the hotel.
Okay,
and
we could please just have a departing prayer. Lawrence, can I ask you to dismiss us with prayer?
Almighty and most merciful God, we thank you for this day, for all of the experiences we've had, for all the attention we've had from you. We pray for the protection that you will give us tonight. We thank you for the togetherness we've enjoyed, the one in spirit. We pray that you will be with all of those, our relatives who are not here with us tonight, those we have left home. We pray for the protection, the guidance, the help of all of the youth. We pray that you will protect and comfort all of the elders who are not with us tonight. We pray that you will bless all nations, all of our brothers, all of our relatives. All this we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
You're welcome.